beam you up. It's Andrew Rennie and The Space Show.
Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we continue our Mars series with the latest news about the Mars 2020 rover Perseverance. And we have a poem about Perseverance's older sister, Curiosity. And Robert Zubrin puts forth his ideas about getting humans to Mars. And the genesis of an anthem for Mars, courtesy of the Mars Society. Let's go with Space Show News. The Mars 2020 rover Perseverance made its first drive last Friday. The 6.5-metre drive served as a mobility test as engineers progressively test out the rover's systems and instruments. The six-wheel drive responded superbly, said Anais Zarafian, the rover's mobility testbed engineer. The drive lasted about 33 minutes, and you can work out how many millimetres per minute that is. Perseverance first moved forward 4 metres, then turned in place 150 degrees to the left, and backed up 2.5 metres. The rover's cameras were switched on to image the spot where Perseverance touched down. This allowed the engineers to see what the retro rockets had done to the surface during the landing. The drive happened after mission controllers had completed a computer software update. The program that had controlled the landing was deleted and replaced with another that will control the actions of the rover as it explores Jezero Crater. On Thursday last week, engineers unstowed the 2-metre-long robotic arm. Over 2 hours, they flexed its 5 joints. Now, by last Friday, Perseverance had sent about 7,000 images back to Earth. When the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landed in Gale Crater in 2012, the touchdown site was named Bradbury Landing in honour of the science fiction writer Ray Bradbury, who often wrote about Mars. The Perseverance site has been named Octavia E. Butler Landing in honour of the late science fiction author. She lived in Pasadena and won both the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award. And Butler died in 2006. Well, as we said, the Curiosity rover, which landed in Gale Crater in 2012, had its landing site named after Ray Bradbury. So we've asked Judith Vinnell, who presents the program Stay a While on Southern FM on Monday mornings after the 11 o'clock news, to pop in and read the poem At Bradbury Landing by Stuart Atkinson. And he wrote this in 2012, just as the rover was beginning to move away from the landing site. So here's Judith.
At Bradbury Landing by Stuart Atkinson. In years to come, pilgrims from every crowded corner of Sol's system will journey to this pale and dusty place. From the rain-soaked fields of Earth and Titan's poisonous frozen plains, from Europa's cross-hatched canyons, Mercury's melting mountains and Luna's ash-grey mare, they'll come, their hands and faces stained with the dirt of a dozen different worlds, to stand at Bradbury Landing. Here, where a rover, a century before it was displayed in the Great Museum of Mars, turned its mighty oil drums for the first time, leaving behind tracks in the fines that the wind swiftly blew away. They'll stand in silence, listening to the hissing of their helmet-heated air, staring in disbelief at the summit of Mount Sharp, drenched in molten gold, aeolian glow by the rays of the setting sun, and whisper, "Thank you," to the man who took mankind to Mars. At first, a simple ceremony, standing on the paprika and cinnamon sands, as Martian tradition demands, each will hold in his or her shaking hands a copy of a book. The book, his book, each one a gift from one of Terra's sister's worlds, not to lay on the ground in tribute, not to offer as space, age, gold, frankincense or myrrh, but to exchange with fellow travellers, each handover continuing the journey Bradbury began when he first sat down and started to write his beloved chronicles. In the following years, the landing will no doubt grow busier, attracting more and more skin-suited history and sci-fi junkies from far and wide, each standing there, wide-eyed, in front of the upturned goldfish bowl dome that protects the rover's chevron tracks. Not the originals, of course, those will be long gone, but faithful reproductions, lovingly sculpted out of the rocks and dirt and stone by Mars Heritage volunteers desperate to honour both man and machine, recreating the path of that first historic drive, that Martian Kitty Hawk first flight, when curiosity began to rove and the new world opened up before us. Later still, when snow globe oases of green and blue are starting to bloom on Mars, Bradbury's followers will climb Aeolus Mons to stand on its star-scratching summit to see the book brought vividly to life. Some will take the easy route, walk one, the one that follows curiosity's own path towards and then across the moat of dunes, up to and through the foothills, twin moons shining down on them as they wend their way between the crumbling, rock-tumbling mesas and butts before heading up to where the fork dragged through mashed potato, lie-toned unit finally surrenders a view of the real peak. Others will seek a boulder route. Walk two, an ankle-twisting trek up older canyons, clambering over striped ochre outcrops until finally the peak rears up ahead. Then all will slog their way up to the top, to stand on the summit of Mount Sharp and gaze down at Gale, stretched out before them like a pioneer's quilt wonderland of ancient epic stone. And standing there, they'll see the most moving scenes of the book brought vividly to life. Plugged into MarsNet's virtual reality, they'll gaze up into the butterscotch sky and find it's full of 50s-styled sleek-ringed rockets, silver locusts dropping to the ground for miles and miles around, each one bringing another crowd of settlers from the next world in. Over there, an American Midwest town, perfect in every way, white picket fences shining like bones, manicured lawns and parks glowing emerald green in the sunlight. Impossible, but there. And over there, shivering, cold in the shadow of Mount Sharp, the remains of a Martian city. Once elegant with temples, halls and homes so starkly beautiful, they made the dark Martians weep with pride. Its ruins would now make them hide their golden eyes behind their hands. Time has left nothing standing taller than a tree. The stump of snow-white pillars jut from the ground like broken teeth. the canal that curled its way through the city's jeweled heart, carrying cool, clear water. From the pole is bone dry now, an artery clogged with dust. And over there, on the amber-hued plain that laps up against the crater's southern wall, a dozen martial sand ships in a line, cobweb-fine sails billowing in the whispering wind, shining 100 shades of sapphire, silver and gold as they flow across the sands like wine before vanishing like ghosts. Back on the gritty floor of Gale, one more thing to see, one last thing for a pilgrim to do before they can return home to their outback hab or pressurized dome. Out there, halfway between the crater's Arakeen shield wall and the rock falls, at the once Bayer-camouflaged base of the promised land, a narrow strip of shouldn't-be-there blue, a slashed sapphire wound in the rust-hued landscape that once glimpsed pulls you relentlessly forward it like a siren, an even horizont, an event horizon of beauty from which there can be no escape. Bounding to it brings a reality-lurching surprise. Suddenly you're standing on the side of a canal, an honest-to-God Martian canal cut out of the ground, filled, impossibly, with water that slops and slaps sleepily against the sides. A simple handwritten sign stands beside it, bearing the words, "Look in to see a Martian." And as you do, leaning carefully over the edge, you already know what you will see, your own reflection staring back at you.
Thank you, Judith. That was Judith Vinell reading At Bradbury Landing, a rather fanciful look at the future of the Curiosity landing site. Curiosity landed in 2012 in Gale Crater, and of course this year in 2021 we had the Mars 2020 rover Perseverance land in Jezero Crater. Well, one of the aims of Perseverance is to collect samples that can be brought back to Earth probably around about the year 2030-2031. So how are they going to store the samples? Well, we have this feature from the Goddard Space Flight Center about how they're going to collect those samples.
We are working on something that is the cleanest we've ever really attempted to send into space.
The Perseverance mission has as its central goal astrobiology and also being the first step in Mars sample return. We're going to collect a suite of samples, about 35 samples, that each weigh about 15 grams.
I mean, the reason we collect those intact samples is that we are the first mission that's part of Mars sample return, and it's our job to collect the samples intact to be brought back to Earth for further analysis.
To better assess the question of, was there life previously on Mars? Inside the belly of the rover sit a number of sample tubes and an entire adaptive caching assembly that is used to help collect these samples.
Extraordinarily complex robotic system. And to make it even more complicated, it has to be super clean. We don't want to have these samples come back from Mars and discover life in them, but then realize, oh, that's life that was in the apparatus when we sent it to Mars.
That was a big challenge for the mission because we were meeting cleanliness standards that no rover mission has ever had to meet before.
The requirements that we have for this mission are extraordinarily challenging.
Once we would go through machining the tube itself, getting all of our protective coatings on there, and then looking at our beautiful tubes, we found carbon contamination in places we were not expecting. So as a team, we all had to really come together and look at the entire manufacturing process, how we're handling these tubes. We had to start polishing the interior bore prior to putting on some of our protective coatings.
It meant having to come up with an entirely new technique to clean all of the hardware and demonstrate that the hardware could maintain that cleanliness all the way to Mars.
That's what JPL does. I mean, we discover problems and then we solve them.
Having these very strict controls and this record of how much contamination or how clean these tubes are prior to going to Mars is essential for that return sample science.
Great discoveries require remarkable evidence. And so the cleanliness of the sample tubes and of all of the hardware that's going to be collecting those samples is paramount in making sure that the evidence and that the story and that the discoveries that come from these samples that are brought back are irrefutably Martian.
Thank you to the Goddard Space Flight Center for that. Now, the Mars Society is an organization that's been around for quite a few years. They're pretty gung-ho about going to Mars. And one of their chief advocates is Robert Zubrin. Now, Robert believes that we could go there and live off the land, as it were. That is, we could go there and make the oxygen and stuff that we need to live there. Well, the Mars 2020 rover, Perseverance, is going to test that idea. So we'll hear more about that coming up in the space show. Well, this Mars Society sort of needs a bit of an anthem. And Oscar Castellino and Robert Zubrin wrote the anthem for the Red Planet. It's called Rise to Mars. And here is Oscar to describe how it was written.
Rise to Mars, men and women, dare to dream, dare to strive. Rise to Mars, men and women, dare to dream, dare to strive.
My medium is music, so I thought I could create a song that inspires people and educates people about our scientific ability as humanity and how far we've progressed. A tune came in my head. Ta-ta-da, ta-ta-ta-da. And I wrote the tune. I wrote a tune, and the tune just spoke to me, and the lyrics sort of appeared. So it was just sort of very organic, so to speak.
Challenges before us that nature never knew, but the power of human end.
So we want something that's singable, and I thought, okay, something that's singable has very short phrases. Da da da, da 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 da. So that is Rise to Mars. Easy, anybody can sing that.
Going to be a whole gamut of skills and talents and interests that are going to get humans to Mars. We're going to need also poets and artists and 3D designers, you know, and they're going to need to have a normal life. It will be a lot of hard work, but at some point they're going to want to be inspired as well.
For a future, rise to Mars!
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
All right, we're now going to hear from Robert Zubrin. Now, Robert Zubrin is the president of Pioneer Astronautics. He lives in Lakewood, Colorado, and is very much involved in the Mars Society. He came to Melbourne in 2016 and spoke at RMIT. Now, unfortunately, the RMIT technician left on the lectern microphone, which not only captured the ambient sound, but also Zubrin whenever he was near the lectern. And so the feed is mainly off a radio microphone that he was carrying on his body, but there is this other microphone active in the auditorium. And unfortunately, I couldn't do anything about that. So here we go with Robert Zubrin speaking at RMIT University in 2015. Did I say 2016? 2015.
I think this is the most important thing going on in this world at this time. Not this lecture in particular, but this endeavor of which this discussion is part. I'm an American. You ask any American what happened in 1492, say Columbus made his voyage, and that is correct. But there's a lot of other things that happened in 1492. In 1492, England and France signed a peace treaty. In 1492, the Borgias took over the papacy. In 1492, Lorenzo de' Medici died. Okay, lots of things. And especially the Borgias taking over the papacy, if they had had newspapers in 1492, that would have been the big headlines. Okay, not, you know, that some Genoese weaver's son got some boats and went off in some direction that nobody with a right mind would ever go and you know, found some islands inhabited by savages or something. I mean, and yet that's what is remembered. What are people going to remember 500 years from now? Are they going to remember which group of fanatics came out on top in Syria? Or who got in or who got out in the latest government scandal and overthrow? Or whatever? No, they won't care about that stuff. They won't even know about that stuff. But what those people living not only on Mars, but on hundreds of planets orbiting stars in this neck of the galaxy are going to think about when they think about this time is they're going to remember this time because this is when people first set sail for other worlds. This is the enduring achievement of our age if we can pull it off. And so, thanks for wanting to get involved in it. Now, as you have seen, I don't speak the native language, but I'm learning it, so I'll try to use a few expressions to be comprehensible, which will probably be inappropriate, but anyway, let's get a wriggle on. And start talking about the subject at hand, which is humans to Mars within a decade. I'm going to talk at some length on how I think that could be done. Perhaps I'll talk a little bit about why I think it needs to be done in such a time frame if it is to be done. And a little bit about why I think it needs to be done, period. That's an awful lot to talk about in a talk of an hour. I won't be able to cover it all adequately, or frankly, any of it adequately. But as Guy pointed out, I have written a book on the subject, which unfortunately we sold out of all the copies that I brought at the previous talks. But it's still available on Amazon, in print, in Kindle. If you think what I have to say is interesting, get it. And if you think what I have to say is important, join the Mars Society Australia. Okay, so humans to Mars within a decade. How can anybody propose such a thing? Okay, those of you who have followed this subject for a while have no doubt seen many concepts of this sort as how we're supposed to go to Mars. This is a current NASA concept for the first human mission to Mars. Okay, it involves a gigantic interplanetary spaceship. I call it the Death Star. It's very large. You can see Mars is here for scale. It's gigantic nuclear powered ion drive or plasma drive or whatever. It should be self-evident that if this is what is required to go to Mars, we're not going to Mars in 10 years. And in fact, you're not going to Mars ever because nothing like this would ever be built until we have a mature interplanetary civilization that would desire such artifacts and be capable of building them, okay? But this is not what is required to go to Mars. This is what is required if you want to have a science fiction movie about going to Mars with impressive computer animated special effects. But it's not what's needed. What is needed? Well, It's to answer that question that a group of engineers, led by me and another fellow named David Baker, set about designing the Mars Direct plan. And the name Mars Direct is suggestive both of the actual flight mode suggested in the plan, but also programmatically. That is, it's direct punch. It does not involve any diversions. The thing was provoked by, you see, in 1989, the first President Bush got up in front of the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., flanked by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, the Apollo 11 crew, and he said, this is the 25th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. That was great. That's what America's all about. And therefore, I, as President, am committing us to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and this time to stay. It's great stuff. So NASA went off nominally to devise a plan on how this could be carried out. But what they really were doing was devising a plan on how they could make use of this presidential imperative to justify the complete assortment of technology programs that they wanted to get funded. So they designed the most complex Mars initiative you could possibly imagine, involving orbital bases, lunar bases, this, that. Okay, all this stuff that you didn't really need in order... In other words, and that pretty much killed the program right there, with a massive cost estimate, $400 billion, a huge timeline. But really, they were not developing a plan to get to Mars. They were developing a plan to make use of the fact that somebody else wanted to get to Mars to sell what they had to sell. And this is the exact opposite of the correct way to do engineering. You don't do an engineering project in order to spend money to fund a lot of people. Okay, that's like running your company in order to fund your vendors. Okay, you, if you're running a company, you may need vendors, you probably do, but you want to use the fewest of them you can and pay them as little as possible. Okay, whereas they were going the other way. So what is the sound way to go about designing a Mars mission with as few vendors as possible? Okay. Now, by the way, I want to talk about that. So any space plan requires an appropriate launch vehicle. And in order to keep the number of launches down to a minimum, we decided we wanted to have a launch vehicle with equivalent capability to the Saturn V that we used to go to the moon during the Apollo program. And because the Nixon administration, in its infinite wisdom, had scrapped the assembly line of the Saturn V and, in fact, given the blueprints to the Boy Scout paper drive in Huntsville, Alabama, that's true. I'm not making this up. We designed a heavy lift vehicle to be built out of shuttle hardware. Okay? So this is the vehicle we designed. We call it the Ares after the Greek name for Mars. And so it's pretty fairly straightforward. External tank, shuttle external tank without the ogive, which is the pointy top. We don't need that. Couple of solids. They're in current manufacture. And then a pod of four space shuttle main engines, which were offset thus, because at the time this was designed, the shuttle was still flying, and we wanted to use the shuttle launch pads, which have their flame trenches positioned here. Now, the shuttle's no longer flying, so if you were to develop a vehicle like this, you would no longer do this. You'd just put the engines directly underneath, and it would improve performance a little bit. Well, what could the vehicle... Oh, and one more thing. The vehicle has an upper stage, which is hydrogen-oxygen propulsion, with 250,000 pounds of thrust, a million newtons, which is the same amount of thrust as you had in the J2 engine that powered the upper stages of the Saturn V. So that's, well, it's technology that we have. And then on top of it is a fairing 10 meters in diameter, or 33 feet if you work at Lockheed Martin. So it's quite capacious, can hold big payloads. Now people ordinarily rate launch vehicles by what they can lift to low Earth orbit, LEO, LEO. And if you want to know, Ares could lift 120 metric tons. Now that is a lot. It's a lot more than Shuttle could lift 20. Ariane 5 can lift 20. Proton can lift 20. Titan IV, which was flying at that time, could lift 20. This is 120, six times as much. So that might seem humongous. On the other hand, it's not unprecedented at all. Saturn V could do 140. Sort of amazing. You think about the space program as pushing the frontier of technology, and in a certain way it does, but, or it did. We in the space program today have, in a number of very important respects, less capability than we had 45 years ago. We're kind of like people living in Italy around the year 800 AD, that is about a few hundred years after the fall of the Roman Empire, but all the impressive ruins are still around for viewing, and the giant colosseums and temples and aqueducts and so forth. And you're wandering around looking at this stuff and saying, we once built that? How could anybody have built that? No one could build that. And yet there it is. And there it is. So you could develop a vehicle like this for sure, because we once did.
That's Robert Zubrin, the president of Pioneer Astronautics from Lakewood, Colorado, and one of the founders of the Mars Society. More from Robert coming up. But first, let's go back to that anthem that Oscar Castellino and Robert Zubrin composed. Here's a performance by Oscar himself. 1,500 school children, can you imagine that? 1,500 school children, and the Royal Welsh Symphony Orchestra. And this performance was done in Wales. The anthem for the Mars Society, Rise to Mars, sung there by Oscar Castellino, who also wrote it, and 1,500 school children in the Royal Welsh Symphony Orchestra. More about Robert Zubrin coming up in a few moments.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM,
where this is the Space Show. Robert Zubrin, president of Pioneer Astronautics, Lakewood, Colorado, spoke in 2015 at RMIT University. We had a few problems with the microphone, as you probably heard. But anyway, let's go on now and hear what he has to say about getting humans to Mars.
Now, however, Like the Saturn V, and unlike, for example, the space shuttle, this vehicle has an additional capability. Because it has an upper stage, it is not limited to sending payloads to low Earth orbit. It can use the upper stage to throw payloads far beyond low Earth orbit. It can throw 47 tons on a direct trajectory to Mars, or 59 to the Moon. And that's how we want to do the mission. Just lift and throw and let it go. Send the payload to the planet with the upper stage of the booster that lifted it to space in the first place. That's how we've done every real unmanned planetary mission, you know, like Curiosity and Viking and Voyager. That's how we did the real Apollo missions to the Moon, okay? You know, and if we can do the Mars mission that way, instead of by going to orbit and assembling Battlestar Galactica spaceships and orbiting space harbors and so forth, if we can just do direct throw, right there you've gone 90% of the way towards taking the mission out of the science fiction future and putting it in our world of real engineering. But how can you do that? The Death Star that I showed you and similar concepts weighs 1,000 tons or so. The booster that could lift that in one launch, it would be quite difficult to develop, and you'd blow away Orlando when you took off, which would be bad for morale at the Cape. So what else can you do? How can you do a Mars mission with a Saturn V class booster if it's 1,000 tons? Well, 1,000 divided by 120 is around 8. You could divide the mission up into 8 chunks and rendezvous in various places in Earth orbit and interplanetary space and Martian orbit on the Martian surface or some combination of such maneuvers and somehow put the mission together that way. And you could design a Mars mission that way. In fact, I actually know someone who once did design a Mars mission that way, and that's why he's out of the business, because that's really stupid, okay? If you have a mission and it requires 8 launches, they're all mission critical, and one goes in the drink, you lose the whole mission. So that is not a reasonable plan. Now, I and a fair number of other people are willing to count on 2 launches, both working. Okay, but 1,000 by 2 is 500. It's still much too much for a Saturn V class booster. So what else could you do? Well, how about getting the mass down? Why is the mass of the Death Star so big? If you look at the Death Star itself, and similar concepts, there's a variety of them one could choose from, what you see is that about 75% of the mass that it is sending to Mars is the propellant to come home. Why do we need to do that? Well, it might seem prudent. I mean, shouldn't, if you go to Mars, bring the propellant to come home? That would seem to be a pretty good idea. Well, it might seem that way, but you have to ask yourself, is that how people have actually explored on Earth? You know, in my country, the most noteworthy episode of exploration is the mission of Lewis and Clark. Couple of explorers, actually, they had 25 other guys with them, so there were 27 of them. But anyway, they crossed the North America from east to west and back again around 1804. It took 3 years. Did they bring with them all the food, water, and air for themselves and their horses for a 3-year transcontinental mission? No. If they had, they would have needed a wagon train of supplies for every man and for every horse. And of course, each of the wagon drivers and each of the wagon horses would have needed another wagon train. And the wagon drivers and wagon horses of those would have needed further wagon trains and so forth. And not only would this have blown the budget of Thomas Jefferson's America, it would have exceeded the mass of the Earth because it would have gone exponential. Now, so that's not how they did it. What did they do? They hunted their way across, and to a certain extent, they got supplies by trading with Native Americans. But in either case, what they were doing was making use of the resources in the environment they intended to operate. Okay? Why are we going to Mars? We're going to Mars because Mars is the planet that has the resources for life and therefore technological civilization. If we can make use of those resources, the same resources that make Mars interesting is what could make it attainable. So the question then becomes, what is the travel light and live off the land approach to Mars exploration? So that's the question that we set about to answer. So here's the mission sequence chart for Mars Direct. You can launch to Mars every 26 months, little more than once every 2 years. I mean, actually a little less frequency than once every 2 years. So year one on this chart is the first year of active flight operations. I think if we were serious about this, year one on this chart could be, 2024, a little less than 10 years from now. Year three would be 2026. But I'm not into predictions, but that, from the point of view of technology, I think that's entirely doable. But anyway, in a given year, year one, call it 2024 if you like, we launch one of these boosters off the Cape, and then we use its upper stage to throw an unmanned payload, it's unwomaned too, there's actually no one in it at all, on a minimum energy trajectory to Mars. That is, the easiest trajectory to Mars takes 8.5 months to go there. Okay, and it glides on out to Mars, and then when it gets close to Mars, it deploys an aero shield, which uses it to make friction against the Martian atmosphere and aero capture it from an interplanetary trajectory into a bound trajectory around Mars. And then after we check it out and check out the Martian weather, make sure it's a good time to come in for a landing, we then direct it further deeper into the atmosphere. We use the aero shell to plow us down to subsonic speeds. Then we pop parachutes, come down slow, and then put ourselves down softly on Mars with rockets, just like we did with Viking in 1976, or in a different way with an analogous system with Curiosity in 2012. So, what is it that we have landed on Mars? The payload consists of a number of things. The primary object is an Earth Return Vehicle, or ERV. Okay, and what the ERV is, it's a little rocket ship for flying from Mars to Earth. It's going to take a six-month voyage from Mars to Earth in the final leg of the mission with four people in it, so it's got a little cabin up there that can accommodate four people in modest quarters for 6 months on the way home. But no one's in it now. Then we have two rocket stages that run on methane-oxygen propulsion. However, they are unfueled. They have to be unfueled or this thing would weigh four times as much as it does. It'd be much too heavy for a Saturn V-class booster to shoot off to Mars. However, in some of the lower stage tanks that are later going to contain methane, we got about 6 tons of liquid hydrogen, probably in gelled form, and then slung below the vehicle, not shown in this diagram, we got a light truck, like a little pickup truck, runs on a methane oxygen engine, and sitting in the back of that truck, we got a little nuclear reactor with a power of 100 kilowatts. 100 kilowatts is like 130 horsepower, same amount of power that drives a medium-sized car. So we're not talking about some gigantic nuclear power plant that powers a city or an aircraft carrier or a nuclear submarine. We're just talking about a nice little putt-putt nuke sitting in the back of a truck. Okay. And then what happens is we telerobotically drive the truck a few hundred meters away from the landing site, unwinding a cable off the back of it as it goes. And then we put the reactor on the ground, preferably in a crater or a ditch, or just put it on the reverse side of a hill, anything to put a good-sized chunk of dirt between the reactor and the Earth Return Vehicle. And then we turn the reactor on, and now we have power, and we run a pump, and we suck in the Martian air. Mars has got an atmosphere. It's 95% carbon dioxide gas. Carbon dioxide, CO2, can be reacted with hydrogen in the presence of a catalyst to produce methane and water, CH4 methane water H2O. This is a very well understood reaction. It's known as the Sabatier reaction. It dates from the gaslight era. Okay, and this is an exothermic reaction. That is, it doesn't take any energy to drive. It produces energy. And it has a very high equilibrium constant, like 10 to the 7th, which means that it goes to completion in one pass, period. Okay, so There's methane. That's natural gas. It's excellent rocket fuel. We store that in our tanks. That's our fuel to come home. We take the water. We split it via electrolysis, also 19th century chemistry. Oxygen we store in other tanks. That's our oxidizer to come home. The hydrogen we recycle, react with more CO2 to make more methane, and so forth. Okay. Then finally, to get additional oxygen, which is desirable, in order to get the right mixture ratio for the rocket, we have a third reactor in which we take carbon dioxide and we split it into carbon monoxide and oxygen. The oxygen we store as oxidizer, the carbon monoxide we vent as waste. You can do that on Mars. There's no environmental protection agency there, which is a very important positive feature of the planet. Now, and by the way, I should mention that this third reaction is actually going to be demonstrated on the Mars 2020 rover. The experiment has been scheduled for that. Okay. And the other two reactions have been extensively demonstrated in test apparatuses on Earth. Now, so what you've managed to do with all this is you've taken 6 tons of liquid hydrogen from Earth, and you've turned it into 108 tons of methane oxygen bipropellant on the surface of Mars. That's a leverage of 18 to 1. It's like a pioneer, you know, being able to acquire the useful mass of a bison for the transport of the mass of several bullets and cartridges. And that's what makes the whole, or kangaroos in this case. That's what makes the whole mission sing. 95% of the return propellants coming from Mars, 5% came from Earth. Because of that, we can make extra propellant. We only need about 90% of that 108 tons to power the Earth return vehicle. The other 10%, about 12 tons, is available to power ground vehicles using combustion engines. And that's really a good thing because such vehicles have much greater power to mass ratio than you can get with battery powered systems, which is why they're much more popular here on Earth. And in a frontier environment like Mars, where you really do need the long range, the torque, the hauling capability, the speed, and the all-around muscle you have from having a real car instead of a golf cart, you really want to have one. Okay? But it wouldn't be practical to operate one if you had to bring the fuel from Earth. But because you can make the fuel on Mars, then it becomes practical to use such systems, and this gives you much more mobility, which is, of course, the key to exploration, which is what the whole mission's all about. So, I mean, the point I'm making here is that the ability to make use of local resources is not merely the key to making the mission cheap. It's also the key to making the mission effective, which is equally important because there's no point going to Mars unless you can do something useful once you get there.
Speaking at RMIT University, right here in Melbourne, that was Robert Zubrin, the president of Pioneer Astronautics from Lakewood, Colorado, and Robert is very active in the Mars Society. Now, someone who is also very interested in the Mars Society and so on is Elaine Walker. In the year 2000, she recorded this song, which is simply called To Mars.
Be brave, my dear, when my rocket plane departs. I shall return to take you back with me, and then we'll raise our Martian family. I have take you back with me. It's 8 months out in Martian gravity. Remember this, such a long awaited day. We're on to Mars and we're going there to stay. To Mars, to Mars, we're off to Mars today. It's just one world away, he's calling out our name. To Mars, we're going there to stay. When we're on Mars, we'll be halfway to the stars. Longer days and lighter on our feet. Now we are Martians and we are truly free. Our children will have only Martian memories of building a nation of camaraderie. We're pioneers and we're living off the land. A whole new world we are building with our hands. Our air and fuel from the Martian atmosphere.
To Mars, Elaine Walker. Oh, Judith has just popped back in and she's got another little teaser poem for us.
Rusty red surface, cratered, layered, rocky plains. Someday we'll touch Mars. Tracy Drain, JPL Systems Engineer.
And that poem called Touch Mars. Well, just a reminder as the space show winds up this evening, we plan to have Robert Zubrin back again. Yes, he has agreed to come back. Well, it's time to sign out here on the space show. I'm Andrew Rennie, and as we say, we'll be back hopefully at 7 o'clock next week.